G'day, Gladys and Potties. Welcome to another LNL. We've developed this amazing technology which allows me to speak to the dead. And on tonight's program, I shall be talking live to a very dead Kurt Vonnegut. It's one of the programs that we've got in our 20-year retrospective called In Bed with Philip. And the other is with the great Australian gardener Peter Cundall. Of course, both Peter and Vonnegut, wonderful old lefties. Way back when, over 40 birthday candles ago, when my cake didn't look like a funeral pyre and I still had enough puff in my lungs to blow the bloody candles out, I discovered, as millions did that particular year, a new writer. And I fell instantly and utterly in love with him, as I would a little later with Joseph Heller, for a book of comparable merit, Catch 22. I'm talking about Vonnegut. Our old mate Harold Bloom rates his book Cat's Cradle as a part of the Western canon of literature. But the tome I was talking about was Slaughterhouse-5, and it's dominated in my mind and memory by a wonderful image.
Well, I was very lucky, as it worked.
It's it just that sort of flying backwards from over the burning Dresden, with the bombs sucking the flames in, and then being carried up into the bellies of the aircraft, flown back to Britain, where they were deconstructed and the component parts buried in mines.
Do you know that an Australian set that passage to music?
No, I didn't.
Yes, and I understand it was for sale in Australia. He's working in California now, in Hollywood, and I guess he's writing for movies, a composer. But his name is Simon Heselev, H-E-S-E-L-E-V. And he was a music student, and one of his professors brought me this recording. And damn, he had taken that backward a movie about an air raid and set it to music, and it's a knockout. But I think it was for sale in...
Mike, we'll track it down. The ABC...
Well, all right, well, the name of it, it's a very pretty jacket and everything, is Tock Tick.
Tock Tick. And I presume it's played backwards as well, to be consistent. The voice of Kurt Vonnegut, remarkably lively, because he's 82, he lives on cigarettes, unfiltered Pall Mall. Is that right?
Yes.
And they've kept you going all these years.
And they've made me intelligent.
John Huston once attributed his great age to surgery. So you give yours to cigarettes. It's excellent. You're a great role model. I imagine at the moment you'd like to see that image of your backward-flying bombers becoming U.S. foreign policy, where, of course, the opposite has happened.
Yes, well, you know, I always hope somebody is going to rescue us from our stupidity. And, you know, I thought that, you know, England would be the Greeks to our Romans. And hell, their prime minister is as asinine as our president. I mean, it's really stupid. And what I have tried to ignore, because I'm fond of Australia, but you didn't stop it either.
No, we signed up. We were the first cab off the rank, Kurt. We've always gone to American wars. We're great enthusiasts for them.
Well, you fought very well, I must say, and have the reputation of being ferocious fighters. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I'd prefer us to be ferocious peacemakers at the moment, but do you feel isolated in the United States with your, absolutely firm personal views of on politics? Do you feel like you're the last angry man sometimes?
No, because whenever I tell anybody, unfortunately, I have taught creative writing occasionally, and... what I do and what I've recommended people do is to write a story that says you are not alone, others feel as you do. And there are a lot of people who feel as I do. And They simply are not represented.
And many of them, I think, are listening to this program. Kurt, the other night we did a program on Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
And on his battle with the black dog, you know, with depression.
Yes.
And the scholar who was putting this thesis up said that his deep melancholy gave him a depth of perception that perhaps a happier person wouldn't have had, that it prepared him for his task, you know. And I find that fairly persuasive, being a melancholic.
Well, it's certainly a very romantic idea.
But you're a melancholic, aren't you, in a profound sense?
Yes, but I haven't had a terminal case of it. And I guess the real thing is really quite horrible. But Lincoln, again, had a mild case. And there is this romance. Critics would like to feel, of course, that artists are sick in some way. Or capable people are sick in some way. But whatever made Lincoln what he was is I'm certainly grateful for. And during my own lifetime, I had a great president who seemed a great president to me, was Franklin Roosevelt. And I was talking to a political scientist over here and about Roosevelt and, you know, how compassionate he was. And he said that people in his field were convinced that what made him so compassionate was that he had infantile paralysis.
Mm, mm.
And so he was able to know what it was to be incapacitated.
What gave you your depth of perception? You summed up the subject of all great books as what a bummer it is to be a human being. So
you disagree?
No, I don't. Of course I don't. But I'm sort of happy with being a bummer sometimes, I must admit. But how did you get to this clarity of vision?
I don't know, because I don't credit myself with that. And so from my point of view, I have nothing to explain or wonder about. I was just lucky. That's all I can say. And I have a survivor syndrome, partly because of the Dresden firestorm, of course. There was so much death around and somehow I got out of it. And there have been other events like that where I've survived. But actually, I have known perfectly wonderful writers who got practically no recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what I have said. I'm the asshole who broke the bank at Monte Carlo, you know.
I understand you sometimes have a notice saying, please notice when you're happy.
Yes. Well, that was my uncle's recommendation, and people have thanked me for that. I had a good uncle, which is Uncle Alex, and a bad uncle, who was Uncle Dan. And Uncle Alex said that one thing he didn't like about people was that they so seldom noticed it when they were really happy. And so we would be drinking lemonade under the shade of an apple tree on the 4th of July, and, we'd be talking about this and that and just buzzing like honeybees. And he would all of a sudden interrupt and say, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. And ever so often he would say that. And I try to do that, and I've recommended it in graduation addresses that people do that. And I got one letter who said he customarily says it in the middle of sexual intercourse now.
That's a very good time to say it. Now, listener, would you write that down, right? Please write that down and say it during sexual intercourse and think of Kurt as you climax. I think that's...
If this isn't nice, I don't know what is.
Well, let's go back to a time that was decidedly not nice. Let's go back to 1944 when you were, well, almost a kid in the U.S. Army. You're captured by the Germans.
Yes.
And you're in Dresden when it was firebombed by the Allied forces.
Yes, it was. It was burned to the ground.
100,000 people died.
At least. But, you know, that's Guinness Book of Records stuff. It's, none of these numbers of casualties are all that interesting. It's plenty of people died. That's this beautiful work of art which was undefended, incidentally. The Germans figured if they left it undefended, it wouldn't be attacked. And no war industries there to speak of. And it was a Brit who burned it down in at nighttime with new incendiary bombs. They used to be about the size of a croquet stick, you know, and these were about the size of a shotgun shell. Anyway, they scattered these, just as it was salt or pepper, over a city. And the whole thing burned down. And what I've said, too, is that the war was almost over when they did that, you realize. That was in February, March, April, May. The Germans were in full retreat on all fronts at that time. And I've said that only one person benefited from the firebombing of Dresden. Is not one person got out of a death camp a second earlier. Not one German deserted his defensive position a second earlier. I am the only person who benefited, and I've gotten, I don't know, probably $20 for each person killed. But nobody's ever argued.
And so it goes. That miraculous four words that you use every time someone dies.
Well, it's in every language.
Is it?
Yeah.
And so it goes.
Yeah, it's just acceptance. What can you do?
There's a very famous Australian bushranger. Do you know that term?
Yes.
Ned Kelly, and his dying words on the gallows, he's a great national hero in this country, are said to be, "Such is life."
God, I love it.
It's not a lot different, is it, in its
no,
sense?
No, but good for me. He's my hero, too, now.
Well,
he couldn't have done better.
No. You must say, and so it goes, a lot, because here you are in your 80s, and you would have outlived most of your friends by now.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Well, you had the same experience when you found out that Joe Heller was dead. Yes, it's, and I don't like living this long, but about gallows speeches, I love that one that you gave me, and I'd never heard it before. But a man was about to be electrocuted in Chicago. They used to have the electrocutions in the jail there, and just before they pulled the switch, the man in the chair, I don't remember his name, said, "This will certainly teach me a lesson." That's not bad either, is it?
Oh, dear. There's a great British and Australian by appropriation comedian called Spike Milligan. And he wanted his epitaph to be, "I told you I was sick." What will yours be? "So it goes?"
No. It's the only proof he needed of the existence of God was music.
It's a great line. It's a great line.
Well, it's true. Is music has been so healing for me and so encouraging. And how the hell this noise works, I don't know.
Mm.
But is it ever therapeutic?
I guess with you it's jazz?
No, anything.
Anything. Yeah.
No, I was just I listened to the radio a lot and to recorded music on the radio, and they had a program of Kurt Vile.
Mm.
And my, that sounded good. It all sounds very
But he's
good.
he's a melancholic like us, isn't he? Bleak,
right.
Terrifying songs.
Yes, but well, you have the feeling he's telling the truth.
The voice of the late and truly great American writer Kurt Vonnegut talking to me in 2005. It's one of the chats featured on LNL's online retrospective In Bed with Philip, 200 interviews and discussions from my 20 years of presenting this Little Wireless program. In the new autobiographical memoir, and I'm glad you're still writing despite your constant threats or promises not to do it anymore, Dresden gets a run, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And, well, it's interesting. It was Field Marshal Harris, I guess, who was marshal of the RAF, and they proposed, I don't know, it must be 10 years ago now at least, putting up a statue to him on Trafalgar Square or somewhere, Piccadilly or whatever, and a lot of RAF guys protested. They felt disgraced having bombed civilians. And, well, when my term as a prisoner didn't last very long, actually, it was about 5.5 months, long enough to get a book out of it. But anyway, when we were finally home on a ship and went into port in Virginia, and my best friend, my partner in infantry, Bernie O'Hare, who became a district attorney, incidentally, and then a defense lawyer, I said to him, because we were about to part, he was going to go home to Pennsylvania, I was going to go home to Indiana, I said, "What did you learn?" And he saw in a minute and he said, "I'll never believe my government again." We felt disgraced. We did not know we had that kind of a country that would bomb, you know, civilians, men, women, and children. And we were going to find out very soon that we were indeed that some kind of a country, big time.
Big time. How did you feel when you watched shock and awe over Baghdad?
Well, it was so stupid. I've said on the radio here that, you know, I want to say something good about our president, that he isn't the dumbest person at the top of our government, of our federal government. The dumbest person is our Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. He was dumb enough to believe that he could take control of a country of 25 million Muslims with some great big bangs, and then 200,000 soldiers who couldn't even say hello in Arabic. As you know, I'd never been any but a corporal, but I knew you couldn't do that, and it was exceedingly dumb.
You write that the, and this, I'll quote it, "The America I love still exists on the front desk of a public library."
Yes. Well, we have absolutists in this country who want to know what people are reading and to discourage them from reading. You know, here we're teaching democracy in Iraq. And the librarians, not famous for their physical strength or powerful political connections, have just damn well refused to deal with these people at all, to refuse to take this book off the shelf, or to refuse to tell you who was taking this book out or that book. And so, yeah. And so you say, do I feel alone? No. And there are lots of people behaving honorably.
Kurt Vonnegut, I educated myself in our public library system in Australia. It was one of our great achievements, really. And were they important to you as a kid?
Yes, indeed. And the librarians were so helpful. As they, you know, I got really interested in snakes one time and lizards, and went and told a librarian about it, a woman, and yes, she was deeply interested and wanted to help and felt that she should know more about them too, and all that, just chat, and yes, and she found a book and let me know what you think of this and everything. Oh, what an agreeable world.
I gave a speech to the public librarians here last year, and I thanked them all collectively, because one of them, when I was 13 years old, took me from the kids' library into the grown-ups' library and gave me Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, and it changed my life.
Okay. Yeah.
What was the book that changed your life, do you think?
Well,
before you started writing books to change other people's.
A lot of... God, that's a... You know, I would have to be hypnotized, or I'd have to...
Okay, my watch is swinging in front of your eyes.
Being being trepid. God, there were so many. I was so grateful for well-told stories.
Mm.
And one of the best-told stories ever was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. "Tell me, Mr. Silver, have you ever seen a real pirate?" How could you beat that?
Yes, no, it's a wonderful book. Wonderful book. Written in the neighborhood, as you know. Just up the road on one of those Pacific islands.
Yeah.
You've had enormous success. And,
I guess.
But at the same time, you self-deprecate a lot. You say that a part of your, as well as being mad about growing old and being mad about it being American, you're not too happy with your 20-plus books.
I don't know. No, I am. But again, I don't understand how I did it. And it happened. It simply came out of me. And so there may be more going on than I know, and I don't deserve credit for any of it. I don't care, but please. I'm quite pleased with how it turned out and surprised. And one of the troubles was being the youngest child in any family is that your parents never find out how you turned out. And I wish my mother and father could see me now.
I'm sure that's right. Do you, when you say that the subject of all great books, certainly the subject of your own, is what a bummer it is to be a human being, you clearly qualify that with a celebration of happiness. Though rare, it's a beautiful thing. So, you know, you're not as grumpy a curmudgeon as you pretend to be, are you?
No, it's luckily not. Again, I think it's a matter of luck. It's because there are some really ferociously grumpy people around. And no, I haven't gone over the line. And I've, what a bummer life is. And what is marvelous is how people respond to the ordeal.
There's another line of yours which I've always loved. We are here on Earth to fart around. Don't let anyone tell you anything different. That's terrific.
Well, yes, but in the age of the computer particularly, you know, we are dancing animals. We like to move around. We don't want to sit on a couch indoors and just do everything on a computer. And so I make errands. I love mailing packages.
Do you put anything in them, Kurt?
Yeah, well, none of your business.
I love the thought of empty packages going in. That, of course, the Patriot Act people, great concern. Packages coming out from Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes. Well, they may be watching me, I don't know.
You're not too enchanted with the computer revolution. You said it's allowed white-collar criminals to do what the mob would have loved to do. Put
yes.
a pawn shop and a loan shark in every home.
Yes, well, it has done that. I am an ultimate Luddite. I mean, if I hadn't been here and you had called, there would not, the phone would have just rung and rung and rung. I don't even have an answering machine.
God, I'm glad I got you.
And I love mailing letters meanwhile, my wife is on the web and knows all about it and enjoys it and has friends all over the world, I guess. I found everything redundant. All the new technology is redundant. And Forbes, a big business magazine in this country, asked a number of us what our favorite technologies were. And I said the Encyclopedia Britannica because it's alphabetical.
Well, you could have done that. You could have written alphabetically. This seems a good time to talk about the technologies that are delivering you to your Australian audience. You're listening to LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and via, I hate to tell you this, Kurt Vonnegut, podcasting. Kurt Vonnegut's latest book is called Man Without a Country, and I was delighted to see something else you and I have in common, and so does Noam Chomsky. We like Law and Order, provided it's got Sam Waterson or Jerry Orbach in it.
Oh, yes, and people have asked me you know, who would you rather be than yourself? And Jerry Orbach, without a question.
Mm. Now, he's dead. I know he's dead, and I'm very sad about that.
Me too. And I talked to him one time, and just, my, he's adorable.
He was also a good hoofer. He was, he was quite significant on Broadway.
Yes, and I never was.
Mm. Now, I'm going to get you into trouble. This next question will probably get you into Guantanamo Bay, but you write about how much you admire Eugene Debs, the great American socialist.
Yes.
Would you dare describe yourself as a socialist today?
Of course. I do, is because I, you know, I'm somebody, and there has to be a certain amount of First Amendment toleration. And so, yes, and so, sure, I say I'm a socialist, and certainly Karl Marx was a great man. What he was trying to do is, you know, since the Industrial Revolution had scattered tribes and extended families, how people could still be taken care of the way a family or a tribe would have done it. And so he laid out this scheme for taking care of a large population, you know, taking care of them in childhood when they're old, which a tribe would have done. And so it was a good try on his part.
I think the other bloke he probably would have tried to do the same things was Jesus Christ. But these days, of course, he seems to vote Republican.
No, people claim he votes Republican. But he's... I have yet one of these Bush supporters to quote Jesus Christ. I don't think they have any idea what he stood for.
Well, you use the word merciful, and that's not an attribute of the religious right, is it?
No, it certainly is not. But the it's Christianity is just a totem. That's all. I'm a Christian. And that bonds me to a whole lot of other people. But one of the biggest secrets in the Second World War was that the swastika was a Christian cross. It was for a working man's party, Christian working man's party, and it's a cross of tools, which is a very nice idea, it's axes.
Mm.
But no.
So a variation on the hammer and the sickle.
Yeah. The Germans had conventional crosses painted on their airplanes and tanks, but that Hitler was a Christian was the biggest secret in the war, I guess.
The religious right, of course, continues to rampage across America, but I was talking to Simon Blumenthal last night on the program, and he was saying that the great Bush experiment is now rapidly becoming unstuck. I hope to live long enough to see that happen. It must be something that sustains you, that hope.
Yes, but he has done such damage. Among other things, we're among the most poorly educated people in the world. So the damage is quite permanent. And also, I'm a kind of a depressing fellow. We have damaged the planet with our drunken binge on petroleum and other fossil fuels, that it cannot recover.
I loved something you wrote. You said you grew up in Indianapolis, which is the home of the famous Motor Speedway and the Indy 500 car race. And you said that when I got here in 1922, this country was already roaring drunk on petroleum. And we are still roaring drunk on petroleum.
Yes, and all anybody is saying is don't stop the party. Keep the petroleum coming any way you can until I'm dead, and after that I won't give a damn. And that's actually going on, you see.
Kurt, how do you feel now? That's a couple of old codgers together. No one's listening. It's just you and I.
How old are you?
I'm not going to tell you because I'm not quite old enough to compete, but I feel as old as you. No, I'm 66, so I feel ancient, you see.
Yes.
How do you feel about time running out?
On the planet?
For you.
Oh, well, I like sleep. I'm crazy about sleep.
Oh, well, you'll be happy when you're dead. You're gonna get... Does your personal sort of theology, cosmology give you an afterlife?
No, absolutely not. And I am, what, do you have people called humanists over there?
Yep, I'm one of them, yeah.
All right, well, we have an American Humanist Association, and I am honorary president of it, and I succeeded the great science fiction writer Isaac Asimov as the honorary president. And no, we don't believe in rewards or punishments in an afterlife, and we serve as best we can. The only abstraction with which we have any real familiarity, which is our community.
Now, I take this position publicly in Australia and am inundated with complaints from readers, not so much from listeners, saying, "With if you don't believe, you cannot have a basis, a moral basis for judgment or for your life." In other words, it's only those God brothers that have a copyright on any sort of morality. What's your answer to that?
Well, it's an awful lot about me as an original. And Nietzsche said something perfectly wonderful, which ought to be quoted more. He said, "Only a person of deep faith can afford the luxury of skepticism." And you can be a skeptic and believe that something perfectly marvelous is going on. You just don't know what it is. And you're not going to take the priest's word for it.
But there is through...
Isn't that a pretty good quote?
It's a lovely quote. But it seems to me that all the way through your life, all the way through your writing, there has been this this deep and profound gratitude for existence, as well as this this awareness of the bleak context in which it takes place. I mean, you're a contradictory old bugger, aren't you?
Well, I'll blow my brains out.
But you've had your share of pleasure. You've had your share of joy.
Yes,
you?
You bet I have.
You've been lucky in some of your relationships. And,
yes, I have, and so I have certainly known highs, and mostly, I hate the world for what it's done to other people, not to me. Is I actually have nothing to complain of, and but what it did to my sister, what it did to my mother, what it did to my father, is what my mother committed suicide. My thesis mentor at the University of Chicago in the anthropology department committed suicide. An agent, a dear agent, committed suicide. And,
but you considered it, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And like Europe, did a poor job of it. Europe has certainly tried to commit suicide twice.
I don't think a writer has any privacy, finally, because, of course, you turn every all personal pain into art. But what was the crisis in your life that got you that close to killing yourself?
An impossible. Well, the answer is too personal. Sorry.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I hate invading privacy, so let's move on. But it's not something you've considered since, I take it. Having stuffed it up.
No, but see, one reason not to do it is to leave a legacy to your descendants that this is a way to solve problems. And since my mother committed suicide, it always seems like a quite satisfactory way to solve problems. And, you know, I've had the example, if Farmer A can harvest 6 bushels of potatoes an hour, and Farmer B, who can harvest 4 bushels of potatoes an hour, joins him, and, you know, then Farmer C comes over, and then Farmer A drops out. How many bushels will they have harvested at the end of the day? And my answer is, I think I'll blow my brains out.
Well, look, I've got, on behalf of lots and lots and lots of Australians, some of whom are listening to you as we talk, and certainly on my own behalf. I'd like to thank you, Kurt Vonnegut, for making life less of a bummer for so many of us.
All right, and can I send a greeting to a pen pal I have over there?
Please.
All right, well, his name is Nigel Gray, and he lives in Western Australia, in Kalamunda, and he and I have corresponded quite a bit, and he's a very good writer, incidentally, so tell him hi. Nigel Gray.
Well, we'll make sure he gets that message. Someone listening to the program will know him, and they'll get back to you. They'll get the message back to him. Kurt, it's just wonderful to talk to you.
Well, you're very easy to talk to, I must say.
Your latest book, just in case you've forgotten this, Kurt, is Man Without a Country, and it's published by Seven Stories Press. Can I give you a call in a couple of years to just check you out again?
Yes, of course. If this isn't nice, I don't know what is.
Thanks, Kurt.
Bye.
As it turns out, I didn't get to speak to Kurt Vonnegut again because he died in April 2007. This is Late Night Live summer season, and you're listening to a couple of the interviews that feature on our website, In Bed with Philip. After a bit of music, Comrade Kundal.